political corruption in Africa is hardly underreported, but in It's Our Turn to Eat, the story of a Kenyan whistleblower, Michaela Wrong relates a story of graft and corruption relatively unknown outside of East Africa that is both shocking and reads like a Hollywood thriller. Ms. Wrong is the author of numerous critically acclaimed books on Africa and has written about the continent for Reuters, the BBC, and the Financial Times. This one is published by Harper, and I'm very pleased that it brings her back to the show. Hello.
Hi.
So what does the phrase, "it's our turn to eat," mean in Kenyan politics?
It's something you hear all the time when you're living there. It's basically describing a system of rule, of administering the country, where one ethnic community gets its man into state house, into the presidency, and then regards that as a great chance to pillage, to gorge itself. So all the contracts go to companies run by people from that ethnic community, all the investment, the roads, and that goes up country to the constituencies involved, and it's jobs for the boys as well. So that's the eating that people are referring to.
So is ethnic another way of saying tribal, or are there differences?
No, I mean, essentially, if you're living in Kenya, people will use the word tribe all the time. I mean, it's very openly used, but, you know, there are a lot of people who take offense, especially in the West, bizarrely. People here are very hypersensitive to the use of the word tribe, but when you're in Africa, that's what people say.
Well, since some of the ethnic groups, I'll use that word, are larger than others, I would assume that some never get to eat.
Yeah, and that's the problem, because what you have is you have this rotating system, but there's a predominance. And in Kenya, for example, two of the presidents have been Kikuyu, and the Kikuyu are a very successful, economically successful group, who were also the most rapidly colonized, so very highly educated, very smart, very sussed. And
Jomo Kenyatta, the first president, was Kikuyu.
He was a Kikuyu, and the current president, Mwai Kibaki, he's a Kikuyu. So outside that system, because the second president was a Kalenjin instead, but outside the system, of course, they're very large tribes that never get involved.
Like the Luo?
The Luo, which is where President Obama's father was a Luo. And what you've seen in Kenya is this growing exasperation, and I think it's a story you see across Africa, where the people who are left out in the cold under an It's Our Turn to Eat system eventually take things into their own hands. And you have explosions of violence because people are so exasperated by being left in the cold.
Well, why has this persisted for so long? A country like Kenya is how many years old now?
Well, independence was back in the 60s, so yeah.
So we're talking about 50 years, almost 50 years.
Yeah.
And you would think that by now some of these ethnic or tribal considerations would have dissolved as people had to work together.
Well, I think a lot of it boils down to individual leadership. And you have countries where this mentality hasn't emerged in the way it did in Kenya. People often talk about Tanzania, and I don't want to get dewy-eyed about neighboring Tanzania. But you did have a president there, Julius Nyerere, who saw national cohesion as being very, very important. So you set up a capital where everyone gathers. You adopt Swahili as your national language. You very much build up that sense of identity. And I think often what you had with the post-independence generation of black leaders in Africa was that they were very good at adopting flags and anthems, but really they were running the place like tribal chieftains, and that's what happened in Kenya.
And is that something that goes back to the colonial period? Because the British have been blamed for so many things.
Yes. Well, a lot of what we're blamed for is quite merited, of course. I think the conclusion I reached was that the colonial experience, it certainly didn't create tribalism. I mean, you did have tribal nation states. You didn't have boundaries in that part of the world as we now know them. So you had these large tribal communities with a strong sense of self-identity. But when you had the colonial system, it became set in concrete.
Well, the Belgians sure exacerbated those tensions, those tribal tensions in Rwanda, Burundi, and
yes,
the Congo. But in my conversations with Wangari Maathai and Dambisa Moyo, both of them said it's about time that we stop blaming the colonial legacy for all of Africa's problems.
Yes.
Is that something that's said a lot in Kenya?
I think it is. I think there's a feeling that conversation has now reached its limit. Of course, it's not only colonialism. I mean, you have to think that there was the superpower interference, which was so disastrous up till the end of the Cold War. But the Cold War ended in 1989. So once again, you know, it's time for a young generation coming through in Africa to take responsibility for their own future. And I think they are. And I think, you know, the hero of my book represents that generation.
My guest is Michaela Wrong. Her book, It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower, is published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So how pervasive was the culture of corruption in Kenya? Does it go back to the colonial period, or does it begin when Jomo Kenyatta becomes the first president?
What's very interesting is if you read the historical accounts of people like David Anderson or Caroline Elkins, your own Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, that the colonial regimes, the settler regime in Kenya before independence, was really very corrupt. I mean, they had their own scams going, their own kind of contracts that would go to, you know, a company run by some high-ranking official and big commissions being paid. So there was a very bad example set. But certainly after independence, you do have this system of rule where Jomo Kenyatta definitely favored members of his own Kikuyu community. And they were streaming into Nairobi, picking up a lot of the land, the farms that had been left behind by the departing whites, and also doing very well in business.
It's often been said that some of the first leaders of countries were great revolutionary leaders, but lousy first presidents.
Yes, yes.
We have these rare exceptions. Nelson Mandela, who does set a better example. In this country, George Washington, who set the tone. And who knows what might have happened if we had had a different first president.
Yeah. Well, of course, Kenyatta, one of the things he did was he held out the hand of friendship to the white settlers who had been running Kenya up until then. And I think there was a sense that people were so grateful that there was this sort of compromising a man who was willing to see sense, because they had demonized him. He was described as the black Hitler.
He was the head of the Mau Mau.
That was one of the accusations they made against him. I mean, actually, a lot of the more radical elements of the Mau Mau really thought he was a sellout. But they had demonized him. And when he came in and he was saying, you know, we don't want you guys to leave. We want you to invest in our future. We want, you know, you are welcome. We regard you as part of this national project. Then there was, you know, people were not prone to criticize after that.
You mentioned that some countries are less corrupt, or at least have tried to be. But how does Kenya compare to other African nations or other third world nations?
It goes up and down. If you look at the Transparency International anti-corruption movement, it publishes a national an index of perceptions of corruption. And at the moment, Kenya's pretty low down on that list. In the first years, when Mwai Kibaki came in 2002, you know, there was a big cleanup. And you saw people being held to account, people refusing to pay bribes at roadblocks, because that's one of the places where you always pay bribes to policemen who stop your car.
Is it because they're so underpaid? Because we hear about things like that in Mexico, where the cops have barely paid a living wage, and so they have no choice?
Well, I'm always a bit wary of that. I think they probably are underpaid, but also this has become part of the system. You know, if you are a civil servant, if you work for a state agency, you know that you have the power to ask for a bribe. And I was talking to a secretary recently, a Kenyan secretary, and asking her how many bribes she paid on average, and she said she paid at the very least 5 bribes a week.
Wow. Just to get through a normal week.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the hero of your book, John Githongo. When did you first meet him?
Oh, gosh. Back in the 1990s, I was a journalist for the Financial Times working in Nairobi. He was working as a journalist himself for the East African. And he was just very impressive, wrote a good column, lots of good ideas, expressed himself really well. And then he went on and joined Transparency International's local chapter. He became the director. And then when I went to cover the elections that put Mwai Kibaki in power, he was named anti-corruption czar in that new government.
But hadn't he made enemies with the previous government, especially during the regime of Daniel Arap Moi?
Yes, he had, because he had done such pioneering work at Transparency International, and he had exposed a lot of what that Moi regime was up to. I think there was a report he issued about the amount of land and portfolio, share portfolio that Moi owned. And yes, he was being followed around in those years by the police. He was hot property.
President Moi's government is estimated to have looted $10 billion from the Treasury. I could only guess where that money went. Switzerland?
I think a lot of it would also be in South Africa, and a lot would be in my own country, in property, in Kensington. You know, the Kenyan elite likes to go shopping at Harrods. It likes, there's that old link with London.
And yet, the sense of Kenya was that it was more of a democracy than many countries in the area.
Yes, it had a multi-party democracy introduced in the 1990s. I always felt that Kenya got a bit more credit than was its fair due. And it was partly because the West always tends to look at places like Kenya and thinks, you know, we need to be friends with this place. We need this place to work. Kenya's in a very troubled area, always has been. You know, Uganda under Idi Amin, if you're thinking back, Somalia, Ethiopia.
We're watching Mugabe right now.
And then Rwanda. So to a certain extent, you know, and this was a pro-Western government in the Cold War, to a certain extent, it got a lot away with a lot.
On the other hand, his hand-picked successor and the party, KANU, relinquished power peacefully after they lost an election.
Yeah.
In the past, that sort of thing was not expected to happen. And we're seeing right now in Iran that you can lose an election and still win the election.
Yes. I mean, I think that was a tremendous rallying around. And people now talk about that being Kenya's second liberation.
Because there was talk of a coup, wasn't there?
It was a possibility in that the army went to Moi and sort of said, you know, your successor has lost. Do you want us to do something? And he said, no, you know, this is not the way it's going to go. And to his credit.
Well, but multi-party democracy had been forced on him earlier. What was what happened to the Kenyan economy during his 24 years in power?
Well, I lived there at the time, and it really it just stagnated. Donor aid was a lot of it was cut off. The IMF program with the country was suspended at regular intervals. Tourists have always been a very important part, tourist industry, and that was also sort of declining. There was a lot of carjackings, a lot of crime, a lot of violent crime. And you just got a sense of a sort of old, decaying, authoritarian regime that was stagnating.
To much of the world, Kenya represented the Leakey family, a very different kind of image.
Yes, but I think that's a misleading image because I think people tend to sort of see Leakey as sort of part of a white, important white community. And I've always been impressed by in Kenya, the white community is sort of largely irrelevant now. The politics are not about the white ex, you know, former, the Kenya cowboys, as they're known. And I think people tend to get Zimbabwe and Kenya mixed up in that way.
Before Mwai Kibaki was elected president of Kenya, hadn't he been the country's finance minister? What was his relationship with President Moi?
He had had a difficult relationship with Moi because he had gone off and set up his own opposition party when that became legal to do so. But yes, there's this curious thing where he becomes president and everyone thinks, oh, this is the great white hope of the country and he's going to clean everything up.
Well, he made those promises, didn't he?
He made the promises, but, you know, he was a man in his 70s and you should look back and think, well, you know, you were the finance minister when some of these scams were taken. Place. I mean, the corruption for which Kenya had become famous certainly took place, some of it, under his watch as finance minister. So are you really going to be able to be the new broom that you're promising?
What was the response of the international community to his victory? First of all, how big was the victory?
Oh, I couldn't tell you the percentage. I'm afraid I'd have to look back at my...
But, I mean, did he win by a landslide?
Yes. It was a very... it was a definitive victory. And it was really because all the tribes that had supported the opposition, who intended to put up their own candidates, had all rallied behind this one candidate. And that was enough to do it. But the response of the international community, I think massive relief. And a sense that we really want to engage with this place. We want to start the aid going again. And
you write that, I'm quoting, what happens in Kenya matters more to the outside world than what happens in other African nations.
Yeah, it does. It's strange because it's not a massive economy, but it's partly a sort of a romantic hold on the imagination. I mean, here, you know, and in my country too, Out of Africa, that film is probably the one that epitomizes Africa for a lot of people. People go on holiday there. People know where it is, so it gets more attention.
Were you hopeful after Kibaki won? You write that in the days following his election, you would often feel ashamed for your professional cynicism.
Well, I am a cynical person. And also, I had lived in Zaire under Mobutu before moving to Nairobi. And to me, there were always much more obvious parallels between the two countries than most other journalists that I used to consult with in Nairobi were ever willing to see. So I must say that I kind of shrugged my shoulders a bit after the election. And then I sort of thought, hey, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just not getting the point. You know, I'm out of sync with the times.
Well, at the beginning, there were suggestions that there would be increased political freedom.
Yes, I know, and they're definitely where. There were a lot of good things happened, and there was a sense that people could breathe again. And you got all these private radio stations opening up, the cyber net spreading across the country. Everyone's got 3 mobile phones. The judiciary was being cleaned up. There was a lot of sort of money was being relayed to the constituencies, so people were holding their MPs to account for what was being spent locally. There were a lot of good things done, it has to be said.
My guest is Michaela Wrong. Her book, It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower. It's published by Harper. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Michaela Wrong. Her book, It's Our Turn to Eat, The Story of a Kenyan Whistleblower, published by Harper's. So we have this election. We have you questioning your own cynicism. What kind of anti-corruption reforms did President Kibaki propose after taking office?
Well, the key thing he did was to appoint John Getongo, my former friend, as anti-corruption czar in the new administration.
Kind of an Elliot Ness, he said.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a new job, never existed before. It was a permanent secretary for ethics and governance. And he also said to John Getongo, listen, you know, I want you inside my office. They were very close. Their offices were right down the corridor from each other. Come in. Anytime, you know, let me know what's going on. I want you to be my eyes and ears. So that was a break with the past.
And that would suggest that he really planned to have a clean administration.
Certainly, I think the intentions were excellent at the start, yeah.
What tribe did John Getongo belong to?
Well, he was the Kikuyu, and he was also part...
So the same as President
Absolutely, Kibaki. And that came to be a very key issue. And very much part of that Kikuyu elite that had done very well. He went to a very posh, expensive private school. He knew a lot of the children of that elite. His father would have shared drinks with Kibaki in the golf club, Karen Golf Club. You know, really part of that patrician aristocracy.
And his father had founded Transparency International. So would you say that reform-minded instincts were in John's blood?
I think that certainly he saw himself when he took that job at Transparency International of seeing through something his dad had started, definitely.
Did he talk to you about his being invited to join the Kibaki government?
Yeah, we had a chat, and I was actually quite alarmed because he sort of presented it that the people who sat on the board of Transparency International, who were older members of the Kikuyu aristocracy, had gone to him and said, John, you know, it's in the bag. You're to take this job. He wasn't really asked. He was told, you know, you're taking this job. But I think he also felt that it wasn't something you can turn down.
But that suggests that they were assuming a certain amount of tribal loyalty.
Yes, I think there was a feeling that this is an important job. We want to go to this young man who is the son of a friend.
Has a good reputation.
Has a good reputation, excellent student, head boy at his school, always regarded as an exceptional in everything he'd ever done. So let's get him on board.
So what was his approach to investigating corruption?
Well, it was he had an open door policy, and he would just say, anyone is free to come in and talk to me. Inevitably, a lot of the information he started getting was from low-ranking members of the civil service. John's a very easy person to talk to. You know, a kiosk owner can talk to him. A chauffeur will end up regarding him as a close friend. So will a diplomat or ambassador. And he was someone who people instinctively confided in. So a lot of people would just walk into his office, give him documents and say, you know, this is a bit worrying. You know, you should have a look at this.
But expectations were a little higher than the way he actually was conducting the job.
Well,
at
the end of the day, he didn't have any powers to arrest anybody. He really was just an information gathering unit, all in him and his colleagues. That's what they were there to do. Yeah.
What was the Anglo Leasing and Finance Company Limited?
This was something that emerged quite quickly. It was a shadowy company that had signed an agreement with the government to provide passport printing services. And it was a very strange contract. It seemed to be inflated. It turned out when he started probing what was going on, it turned out to be nothing but a shop front in Liverpool, of all places. And he began to hear that this was one of a series of contracts, that there were more contracts of this type where money was going out of the treasury, and it didn't seem to be clear that the people who were signing off on the contracts, you know, that they could provide these services. They were all military security contracts. They were all very murky.
Other companies had bid on the contracts as well for a lower price.
That's right, and yet those bids had gone ignored. Once you see that, then immediately you begin to get a bit suspicious.
So President Kibaki had said, my door is always open. Come in and talk to me about anything that you're suspicious of. He went to speak to President Kibaki. What happened?
Well, initially, the message he got from the president was, oh, that's very worrying. Dig away, find out what's going on. And as these other contracts, which were, you know, naval frigates, helicopters, telecommunications deals for the police, for the prison service, as they began to emerge, the tone changed, and it began to be one of irritation, indifference, sort of positively discouraging.
But I don't understand. You ask somebody to do a job, and he has a good reputation. You know he's not corrupt, and then he does his job, and then you get annoyed with him?
Well, I think the president was realizing that those involved went rather high up. And this is what happened, that the ministers that were John's closest colleagues started going to him and saying, John, could you stop this? You know, this was the vice president, the finance minister, the justice minister, the internal security minister. And they kept saying, John, hold off. You know, you're stirring up a hornet's nest.
You called the scandal surrounding Anglo Leasing Africa's Watergate. So it's a big story, and yet it hardly made a dent in the international press. Why do you think that is?
It made a dent, but it didn't last. And I think that boils down to this attitude that we were talking about earlier, that for the West, and certainly for the Western governments that do business with places like Kenya and that lend Kenya and give Kenya aid, it sometimes seems more important to keep a government on board than it is to worry about what they do with our money.
And wasn't much of the corruption in this in the Kibaki administration justified as a way of blocking KANU, the party that had been in power, from returning to power?
Yes, these ministers who were going to John were saying, listen, John, you're investigating your own people. You're investigating us, and they meant, you know, us, the Kikuyu, Meru, and Embu community. And they were also saying, this is all about re-election. You don't want Moi to get back in, do you? You know, we need this money to sort of fight the next election. He never actually believed that, because he was saying that it was quite obvious. If you looked at the cars these guys had started driving, the villas they had started buying, a lot of it was going into private pockets.
And the money was all coming from foreign aid and then going to private pockets?
No, that's not the way it worked. Basically, foreign aid tends to be quite carefully policed and ring-fenced. But what was striking was that the amount of money that was scheduled to be mislaid in the Anglo-leasing deals was roughly equivalent to foreign aid. So the foreign aid was going in, and it seemed to free up the government into thinking that they could just steal the equivalent amount from their own taxpayers' money.
My guest is Michaela Wrong. Her book, It's Our Turn to Eat, the story of a Kenyan whistleblower, published by Harper. So John realizes that corruption and graft are a serious problem here, and you describe him as going through a grieving process.
Yes. Well, I think he didn't want to believe what was happening. And what you see is him going repeatedly to the president, with whom he had a really a very good personal relationship. In a way, Kibaki became like a surrogate father to John, and John really respected him. And I think you just see him repeatedly briefing this president and just being puzzled and puzzled and more puzzled. And then suddenly the penny drops and he realizes the president's part of this.
He starts making recordings.
Yes.
He tapes a tape recorder to his stomach.
Well, this is what's so extraordinary about the story. This is why I called it Africa's Watergate, because it involves a lot of secret recordings and microphones. Because he was scared that one day someone would turn around and say, actually, you know, John Githongo is Anglo-leasing, and that he would end up being scapegoated, he mic'd himself up for a lot of these key conversations with the ministers who were confessing everything.
Until there was an embarrassing moment when the tape recorder on his stomach somehow switched to play mode.
Yeah, there was a moment where he skirted being uncovered. I mean, you can imagine what the reaction would have been. He was at a key conversation with the Justice Minister and the Finance Minister, who were very relaxed and being very open about what was going on with Anglo-leasing. And he suddenly realizes that the tape recorder's on play and that there's sounds coming out because the voices are coming back. And so he staggers out and rushes to the loo and adjusts it all. And sort of goes back and continues. I think the nerve it took to do that.
And then he came to your house on February 2005. What had happened that led him to come to you?
Well, you just see an accumulating situation where he's getting more and more. He's getting anonymous death threats at night. He's getting more and more warnings from the ministers who's saying, John, you have to stop.
So he was hiding in your apartment?
Yeah, and he came and he turned up and hid out, basically went underground. Everyone was saying, what's happened to John Githongo? Where's he gone? And he just disappeared for 2 weeks and asked me to send his resignation letter to the president's office, which I did, and tried to collect his thoughts and decide, what am I going to do now?
And he was storing all of the recordings that he'd made on his computer. Was that the safest place to put it?
Well, no, and I was appalled when I realized that this computer that was sitting in my guest room was actually got all this material on it. I mean, it really, you did feel you'd entered into a kind of thriller movie at that stage, and I was sort of having sort of bad dreams about people breaking into my flat and sort of seizing him, seizing the stuff, seizing me.
Well, you could be in serious danger here for harboring
yeah.
what they saw as an enemy of the state.
Well, yeah, it was an uneasy period. I mean, the great, you know, comfort was that one was abroad. One was on British soil, and you just thought, well, they're going to hesitate before they do anything that overt.
Because we're talking about London, but
yes.
President Kibaki launched a manhunt for John around London, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, people from the embassy, the Kenyan High Commission, were going around London trying to find out where he was. And they did track him down eventually.
Well, didn't the British intelligence group community actually help, because they have an agreement, an information sharing agreement with Kenya?
Well, I didn't know if they did help, but they have an information agreement, sharing agreement. And that was why I stopped talking about John over the phone, because I thought if they're looking for him and they might know that we are friends, then who knows, you know, maybe I'm being tapped now. So I became very paranoid at that time.
Did John's decision to flee to Britain for self-imposed exile give his enemies something to attack him with?
Yes, I mean, and that's still a criticism people say, especially members of that Kikuyu elite. They'll say he fled abroad. He's a British spy. Look, he went to Britain, so he must be a spy. He washed our dirty laundry in public. You know, why didn't he try and expose this when he was in Kenya? And they don't realize, of course, that that was what he spent his entire time doing, which was trying to stop and expose Anglo leasing.
They also said that he was a homosexual and a founding member of a group that was exotically named the Royal Gay Society.
That's right, that's right. Well, it's that royal touch, you know, that the sort of British Empire.
Does that group even exist?
No, I'm sure it doesn't. And, you know, the High Commissioner, Edward Clay, was supposed to belong to it at all, and there were supposed to be orgies stage between all these people. So, yeah, there were some really bizarre allegations and smears being spread around.
Although this is not unique in the Third World. We saw a major political figure in Malaysia imprisoned a couple of times because he was accused of being gay.
Yeah. Well, in Africa, in Africa, if you say someone's gay, people in many it's a very macho culture. In many people's eyes, that means you are automatically discredited.
So here we have this man with all this information that was damaging to the Kenyan government. What could he do with it?
Well, that was this really incredibly difficult choice that he faced. I mean, it's a sort of moment of epiphany. On the one side, there's his family, there's his girlfriend, there's that whole life in Kenya, the people he went to school with, there's his Kikuyu community, his grandfathers, you know, his forefathers, and that tie with that community, which is very, very strong. And then on the other side is, you know, his professional duty as an anti-corruption czar. And I think it's extraordinary, really, because what he ended up doing is he ended up deciding, I'm a Kenyan first and a Kikuyu second, and I was appointed to be the anti-corruption czar, and I am not going to keep quiet.
So he made them public, and I'm assuming that some of the organizations that Kenya depends on, like the United Nations and the World Bank, listened to them. What impact did that have on foreign aid?
It had a lot less impact than you might expect. For one thing, a lot of those organizations that you just mentioned knew about Anglo leasing well before John went public with them, because they had been tracking this. There was a lot of rumors flying around Kenya. They knew. And they basically didn't really react dramatically at all. The aid continued. And it sent out, in my view, a very strong signal to that government that you can get away with stealing $1 billion if you want to.
In a review of your book for the Times of London, Stephen Robinson wrote, the British government doesn't really care about corruption in far-off countries. Politicians prefer to be photographed with Bob Geldof and Bono rather than tell the African elites to take their fingers out of the till. But it didn't seem to bother the people of Kenya as well, because the next election, Kibaki's group won again.
Well, they won, but they won because they rigged it. And I think that was the lesson of those elections, was that government became so arrogant and so sure of itself and so also convinced that the donor community, that countries like America and Britain and the World Bank were backing it to the hilt, that it would also be fine if it robbed the election.
Michaela Wrong writes for Reuters, the BBC, the Financial Times, for Slate as well. She's published a number of books, including In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living in the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo. And now it's Our Turn to Eat, the story of a Kenyan whistleblower, which is published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's been a pleasure.